It's no good. And the Patriots take the knee and will now take the journey to Indianapolis. They're heading to Super Bowl 46. 2 weeks later, Super Bowl 46 would score a 60.3 audience share in Boston and a 50.2 share in Baltimore. 60,000 more people in Boston would watch the 2012 advertisements. The next year, the same two teams would meet for the AFC Championship. This time, Baltimore would win. The extra ad exposures for the 2013 Super Bowl advertisements would be seen in Baltimore. Take a look at the comparison on the enhancement. Hal Varian, chief economist at Google, Michael D. Smith, economist at Carnegie Mellon, and I used these two games and all the other Super Bowls from 2004 to 2013 to test whether, and if so how much, Super Bowl ads work. Specifically, we looked at whether when a company advertises a movie in the Super Bowl, they see a big jump in ticket sales in the cities that had higher viewership for the game. They indeed do. People in cities of teams that qualify for the Super Bowl attend movies that were adverted during the Super Bowl at a significantly higher rate than do those in cities of teams that just missed qualifying. More people in those cities saw the ad. More people in those cities decided to go to the film. One alternative explanation might be that having a team in the Super Bowl makes you more likely to go see movies. However, we tested a group of movies that had similar budgets and were released at similar times, but that did not advertise in the Super Bowl. There was no increased attendance in the cities of the Super Bowl teams. Okay, as you might have guessed, advertisements work. This isn't too surprising. But it's not just that they work. The ads were incredibly effective. In fact, when we first saw the results, we double and triple and quadruple checked them to make sure they were right because the returns were so large. The average movie in our sample paid about $3 million for a Super Bowl ad slot. They got $8.3 million in increased ticket sales, a 2.8-to-1 return on their investment. This result was confirmed by two other economists, Wesley R. Hartman and Daniel Clapper, who independently and earlier came up with a similar idea. These economists studied beer and soft drink ads run during the Super Bowl, while also utilizing the increased ad exposures in the cities of teams that qualify. They found a 2.5-to-1 return on investment. As expensive as these Super Bowl ads are, our results and theirs suggest they are so effective in upping demand that companies are actually dramatically underpaying for them. And what does all of this mean for our friends back at the electronics company Levitt had worked with? It's possible that Super Bowl ads are more cost-effective than other forms of advertising, but at the very least, our study does suggest that all that Father's Day advertising is probably a good idea. One virtue of the Super Bowl experiment is that it wasn't necessary to intentionally assign anyone to treatment or control groups. It happened based on the lucky bounces in a football game. It happened, in other words, naturally. Why is that an advantage? Because non-natural, randomly controlled experiments, while super powerful and easier to do in the digital age, still are not always possible. Sometimes we can't get our act together in time. Sometimes, as with that electronics company that didn't want to run an experiment on its ad campaign, we are too invested in the answer to test it. Sometimes experiments are impossible. Suppose you're interested in how a country responds to losing a leader. Does it go to war? Does its economy stop functioning? Does nothing much change? Obviously, we can't just kill a significant number of presidents and prime ministers and see what happens. That would be not only impossible, but immoral. Universities have built up over many decades institutional review boards, IRBs, that determine if a proposed experiment is ethical. So if we want to know causal effects in a certain scenario, and it is unethical or otherwise unfeasible to do an experiment, what can we do? We can utilize what economists, defining nature broadly enough to include football games, call natural experiments. For better or worse, okay, clearly worse, there is a huge random component to life. Nobody knows for sure what or who is in charge of the universe. But one thing is clear. Whoever is running the show, the laws of quantum mechanics, God, a pimply kid in his underwear simulating the universe on his computer, they, she, or he is not going through IRB approval. Nature experiments on us all the time. Two people get shot, one bullet stops just short of a vital organ, the other doesn't. These bad breaks are what make life unfair, but if it is any consolation, the bad breaks do make life a little easier for economists to study. Economists use the arbitrariness of life to test for causal effects. Of 43 American presidents, 16 have been victims of serious assassination attempts, and 4 have been killed. The reasons that some lived were essentially random. Compare John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. Both men had bullets headed directly for their most vulnerable body parts. JFK's bullet exploded his brain, killing him shortly afterward. Reagan's bullet stopped centimeters short of his heart, allowing doctors to save his life. Reagan lived while JFK died, with no rhyme or reason, just luck. These attempts on leaders' lives and the arbitrariness with which they live or die is something that happens throughout the world. Compare Akhmad Kadyrov of Chechnya and Adolf Hitler of Germany. Both men have been inches away from a fully functioning bomb. Kadyrov died. Hitler had changed his schedule, wound up leaving the booby-trapped room a few minutes early to catch a train, and thus survived. And we can use nature's cold randomness, killing Kennedy but not Reagan, to see what happens on average when a country's leader is assassinated. Two economists, Benjamin F. Jones and Benjamin A. Olken, did just that. The control group here is any country in the years immediately after a near-miss assassination. For example, the United States in the mid-1980s. The treatment group is any country in the years immediately after a completed assassination. For example, the United States in the mid-1960s. What then is the effect of having your leader murdered? Jones and Olken found that successful assassinations dramatically alter world history, taking countries on radically different paths. A new leader causes previously peaceful countries to go to war and previously warring countries to achieve peace. A new leader causes economically booming countries to start busting and economically busting countries to start booming. In fact, the results of this assassination-based natural experiment overthrew a few decades of conventional wisdom on how countries function. Many economists previously leaned toward the view that leaders largely were impotent figureheads pushed around by external forces. Not so, according to Jones and Olken's analysis of nature's experiment. Many would not consider this examination of assassination attempts on world leaders an example of big data. The number of assassinated or almost assassinated leaders in the study was certainly small, as was the number of wars that did or did not result. The economic data sets necessary to characterize the trajectory of an economy were large, but for the most part predate digitalization. Nonetheless, such natural experiments, though now used almost exclusively by economists, are powerful and will take on increasing importance in an era with more, better, and larger data sets. This is a tool that data scientists will not long forgo. And yes, as should be clear by now, economists are playing a major role in the development of data science. At least I'd like to think so, since that was my training. Where else can we find natural experiments? In other words, situations where the random course of events places people in treatment and control groups? The clearest example is a lottery, which is why economists love them. Not playing them, which we find irrational, but studying them. If a ping-pong ball with a 3 on it rises to the top, Mr. Jones will be rich. If it's a ball with a 6 instead, Mr. Johnson will be. To test the causal effects of monetary windfalls, economists compare those who win lotteries to those who buy tickets but lose. These studies have generally found that winning the lottery does not make you happy in the short run, but does in the long run. A famous 1978 paper that claimed that winning the lottery does not make you happy has largely been debunked. Economists can also utilize the randomness of lotteries to see how one's life changes when a neighbor gets rich. The data shows that your neighbor winning the lottery can have an impact on your own life. If your neighbor wins the lottery, for example, you're more likely to buy an expensive car, such as a BMW. Why? Almost certainly, economists maintain, the cause is jealousy after your richer neighbor purchased his own expensive car. Chalk it up to human nature. If Mr. Johnson sees Mr. Jones driving a brand new BMW, Mr. Johnson wants one too. Unfortunately, Mr. Johnson often can't afford this BMW, which is why economists found that neighbors of lottery winners are significantly more likely to go bankrupt. Keeping up with the Joneses in this instance is impossible. But natural experiments don't have to be explicitly random, like lotteries. Once you start looking for randomness, you see it everywhere, and can use it to understand how our world works. Doctors are part of a natural experiment. Every once in a while, the government, for essentially arbitrary reasons, changes the formula it uses to reimburse physicians for Medicare patients. Doctors in some countries see their fees for certain procedures rise. Doctors in other countries see their fees drop. Two economists, Jeffrey Clemens and Joshua Gottlieb, a former classmate of mine, tested the effects of this arbitrary change. Did doctors always give patients the same care, the care they deem most necessary? Or are they driven by financial incentives? The data clearly shows that doctors can be motivated by monetary incentives. In counties with higher reimbursements, some doctors order substantially more of the better reimbursed procedures, more cataract surgeries, colonoscopies, and MRIs, for example. And then the big question, do their patients fare better after getting all this extra care? Clemens and Gottlieb reported only small health impacts. The authors found no statistically significant impact on mortality. Give stronger financial incentives to doctors to order certain procedures, this natural experiment suggests, and some will order more procedures that don't make much difference for patients' health and don't seem to prolong their lives. Natural experiments can help answer life or death questions. They can also help with questions that to some young people feel like life or death. Stuyvesant High School, known as Sty, is housed in a 10-floor, $150 million tan brick building overlooking the Hudson River, a few blocks from the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. Sty is, in a word, impressive. It offers 55 advanced placement AP classes, 7 languages, and electives in Jewish history, science fiction, and Asian American literature. Roughly one quarter of its graduates are accepted to an Ivy League or similarly prestigious college. Stuyvesant trained Harvard physics professor Lisa Randall, Obama strategist David Axelrod, Academy Award-winning actor Tim Robbins, and novelist Gary Steingart. Its commencement speakers have included Bill Clinton, Kofi Annan, and Conan O'Brien. The only thing more remarkable than Stuyvesant's offerings and graduates is its cost, $0. It is a public high school and probably the country's best. Indeed, a recent study used 27 million reviews by 300,000 students and parents to rank every public high school in the United States. Sty ranked number one. It is no wonder, then, that ambitious middle-class New York parents and their equally ambitious progeny can become obsessed with Sty's brand. For Ahmed Yilmaz, the son of an insurance agent and teacher in Queens, Sty was the high school. I have changed his name in a few details. Working class and immigrant families see Sty as a way out, Yilmaz explains. If your kid goes to Sty, he is going to go to a legit top 20 university. The family will be okay. So how can you get into Stuyvesant High School? You have to live in one of the 5 boroughs in New York City and score above a certain number on the admission exam. That's it. No recommendations, no essay, no legacy admission, no affirmative action. One day, one test, one score. If your number is above a certain threshold, you're in. Each November, approximately 27,000 New York youngsters sit for the admission exam. The competition is brutal. Fewer than 5% of those who take the test get into Sty. Yilmaz explains that his mother had worked her ass off and put what little money she had into his preparation for the test. After months spending every weekday afternoon and full weekends preparing, Yilmaz was confident he would get into Sty. He still remembers the day he received the envelope with the results. He missed by 2 questions. I asked him what it felt like. What does it feel like, he responded, to have your world fall apart when you're in middle school? His consolation prize was hardly shabby. Bronx Science, another exclusive and highly ranked public school, But it was not STEI, and Yilmaz felt Bronx Science was more a specialty school meant for technical people. 4 years later, he was rejected from Princeton. He attended Tufts and has shuffled through a few careers. Today he is a reasonably successful employee at a tech company, although he says his job is mind-numbing and not as well compensated as he'd like. More than a decade later, Yilmaz admits that he sometimes wonders how life would have played out had he gone to STEI. "Everything would be different," he says. "Literally everyone I know would be different." He wonders if Stuyvesant High School would have led him to higher SAT scores, a university like Princeton or Harvard, both of which he considers significantly better than Tufts, and perhaps more lucrative or fulfilling employment. It can be anything from entertaining to self-torture for human beings to play out hypotheticals. What would my life be like if I made the move on that girl or that boy? If I took that job? If I went to that school? But these what-ifs seem unanswerable. Life is not a video game. You can't replay it under different scenarios until you get the results you want. Milan Kundera, the Czech-born writer, has a pithy quote about this in his novel The Unbearable Lightness of Being. "Human life occurs only once, and the reason we cannot determine which of our decisions are good and which bad is that in a given situation we can make only one decision. We are not granted a second, third, or fourth life in which to compare various decisions." Yilmaz will never experience a life in which he somehow managed to score 2 points higher on that test. But perhaps there's a way we can gain some insight on how different his life may or may not have been by doing a study of large numbers of Stuyvesant high school students. The blunt, naive methodology would be to compare all the students who went to Stuyvesant and all those who did not. We could analyze how they performed on AP tests and SATs, and what colleges they were accepted into. If we did this, we would find that students who went to Stuyvesant score much higher on standardized tests and get accepted to substantially better universities. But as we've seen already in this chapter, this kind of evidence by itself is not convincing. Maybe the reason Stuyvesant students perform so much better is that STEI attracts much better students in the first place. Correlation here does not prove causation. To test the causal effects of Stuyvesant High School, we need to compare two groups that are almost identical, one that got the STEI treatment and one that did not. We need a natural experiment. But where can we find it? The answer, students like Yilmaz, who scored very, very close to the cutoff necessary to attend Stuyvesant. In looking for people like Yilmaz who scored near the cutoff, I was blown away by the number of people in their 20s through their 50s who remember this test-taking experience from their early teens and speak about missing a cutoff in dramatic terms. This includes former Congressman and New York City mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner, who says he missed STEI by a single point. "They didn't want me," he told me in a phone interview. Back to the study. Students who just missed the cutoff are the control group. Students who just made the cut are the treatment group. There is little reason to suspect students on either side of the cutoff differ much in talent or drive. What, after all, causes a person to score just a point or two higher on a test than another? Maybe the lower-scoring one slept 10 minutes too little or ate a less nutritious breakfast. Maybe the higher-scoring one had remembered a particularly difficult word on the test from a conversation she had with her grandmother 3 years earlier. In fact, this category of natural experiments utilizing sharp numerical cutoffs is so powerful that it has its own name among economists, regression discontinuity. Anytime there is a precise number that divides people into two different groups, a discontinuity, economists can compare or regress the outcomes of people very, very close to the cutoff. Two economists, M. Keith Chen and Jesse Shapiro, took advantage of a sharp cutoff used by federal prisons to test the effects of rough prison conditions on future crime. Federal inmates in the United States are given a score based on the nature of their crime and their criminal history. The score determines the conditions of their prison stay. Those with a high enough score will go to a high-security correctional facility, which means less contact with other people, less freedom of movement, and likely more violence from other guards or inmates. Again, it would not be fair to compare the entire universe of prisoners who went to high-security prisons to the entire universe of prisoners who went to low-security prisons. High-security prisons will include more murderers and rapists. Low-security prisons, more drug offenders and petty thieves. But those right above or right below the sharp numerical threshold had virtually identical criminal histories and backgrounds. This one measly point, however, meant a very different prison experience. The result? The economists found that prisoners assigned to harsher conditions were more likely to commit additional crimes once they left. The tough prison conditions, rather than deterring them from crime, hardened them and made them more violent once they returned to the outside world. So what does such a regression discontinuity show for Stuyvesant High School? A team of economists from MIT and Duke, Attila Abdulkadiroglu, Joshua Angrist, and Parag Pathak, performed the study. They compared the outcomes of New York pupils on both sides of the cutoff. In other words, these economists looked at hundreds of students who, like Yilmaz, missed Stuyvesant by a question or two. They compared them to hundreds of students who had a better test day and made Stuy by a question or two. Their measures of success were AP scores, SAT scores, and the rankings of the colleges they eventually attended. Their stunning results were made clear by the title they gave the paper, Elite Illusion. The effects of Stuyvesant High School? Nil, nada, zero, bupkis. Students on either side of the cutoff ended up with indistinguishable AP scores and indistinguishable SAT scores and attended indistinguishably prestigious universities. The entire reason that STI students achieve more in life than non-STI students, the researchers concluded, is that better students attend Stuyvesant in the first place. STI does not cause you to perform better on AP tests, do better on your SATs, or end up at a better college. The intense competition for exam school seats, the economists wrote, does not appear to be justified by improved learning for a broad set of students. Why might it not matter which school you go to? Some more stories can help get at the answer. Consider two more students, Sarah Kaufman and Jessica Eng, two young New Yorkers who both dreamed from an early age of going to STI. Kaufman's score was just on the cutoff. She made it by one question. "I don't think anything could be that exciting again," Kaufman recalls. Eng's score was just below the cutoff. She missed by one question. Kaufman went to her dream school, STI. Eng did not. So how did their lives end up? Both have since had successful and rewarding careers, as do most people who score in the top 5% of all New Yorkers on tests. Eng, ironically, enjoyed her high school experience more. Bronx Science, where she attended, was the only high school with a Holocaust museum. Eng discovered she loved curation and studied anthropology at Cornell. Kaufman felt a little lost in STI, where students were heavily focused on grades, and she felt there was too much emphasis on testing, not on teaching. She called her experience definitely a mixed bag. But it was a learning experience. She realized for college she would only apply to liberal arts schools, which had more emphasis on teaching. She got accepted to her dream school, Wesleyan University. There she found a passion for helping others, and she is now a public interest lawyer. People adapt to their experience, and people who are going to be successful find advantages in any situation. The factors that make you successful are your talent and your drive. They are not who gives your commencement speech or other advantages that the biggest name brand schools offer. This is only one study, and it is probably weakened by the fact that most of the students who just missed the Stuyvesant cutoff ended up at another fine school. But there is growing evidence that while going to a good school is important, there is little gained from going to the greatest possible school. Take college. Does it matter if you go to one of the best universities in the world, such as Harvard, or a solid school, such as Penn State? Once again, there is a clear correlation between the ranking of one school and how much money people make. 10 years into their careers, the average graduate of Harvard makes $123,000. The average graduate of Penn State makes $87,800. But this correlation does not imply causation. Two economists, Stacy Dale and Alan B. Kruger, thought of an ingenious way to test the causal role of elite universities on the future earning potential of their graduates. They had a large data set that tracked a whole host of information on high school students, including where they applied to college, where they were accepted to college, where they attended college, their family background, and their income as adults. To get a treatment and control group, Dale and Kruger compared students with similar backgrounds who were accepted by the same schools but chose different ones. Some students who got into Harvard attended Penn State, perhaps to be nearer to a girlfriend or boyfriend, or because there was a professor they wanted to study under. These students, in other words, were just as talented, according to admissions committees, as those who went to Harvard, but they had different educational experiences. So when two students from similar backgrounds both got into Harvard, but one chose Penn State, what happened? The researchers' results were just as stunning as those on Stuyvesant High School. Those students ended up with more or less the same incomes in their careers. If future salary is the measure, similar students accepted to similarly prestigious schools who choose to attend different schools end up in about the same place. Our newspapers are peppered with articles about hugely successful people who attended Ivy League schools, people like Microsoft founder Bill Gates and Facebook founders Mark Zuckerberg and Dustin Moskovitz, all of whom attended Harvard. Granted, they all dropped out, raising additional questions about the value of an Ivy League education. There are also stories of people who were talented enough to get accepted to an Ivy League school, chose to attend a less prestigious school, and had extremely successful lives. People like Warren Buffett, who started at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League business school, but transferred to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln because it was cheaper, he hated Philadelphia, and he thought the Wharton classes were boring. The data suggests, earning-wise at least, that choosing to attend a less prestigious school is a fine decision for Buffett and others. This audiobook is called Everybody Lies. By this, I mostly mean that people lie, to friends, to surveys, and to themselves, to make themselves look better. But the world also lies to us by presenting us with faulty, misleading data. The world shows us a huge number of successful Harvard graduates, but fewer successful Penn State graduates, and we assume that there is a huge advantage to going to Harvard. By cleverly making sense of nature's experiments, we can correctly make sense of the world's data, to find what's really useful and what is not. Natural experiments relate to the previous chapter as well. They often require zooming in on the treatment and control groups, the cities in the Super Bowl experiment, the counties in the Medicare pricing experiment, the students close to the cutoff in the Stuyvesant experiment, and zooming in, as discussed in the previous chapter, often requires large, comprehensive data sets of the type that are increasingly available as the world is digitized. Since we don't know when nature will choose to run her experiments, we can't set up a small survey to measure the results. We need a lot of existing data to learn from these interventions. We need big data. There is one more important point to make about the experiments, either our own or those of nature, detailed in this chapter. Much of this book is focused on understanding the world, how much racism cost Obama, how many men are really gay, how insecure men and women are about their bodies. But these controlled or natural experiments have a more practical bent. They aim to improve our decision-making, to help us learn interventions that work and those that don't. Companies can learn how to get more customers. The government can learn how to use reimbursement to best motivate doctors. Students can learn what schools will prove most valuable. These experiments demonstrate the potential of big data to replace guesses, conventional wisdom, and shoddy correlations with what actually works causally. Part 3. Big Data. Handle with care. 7. Big Data, Big Schmata. What it cannot do. Seth, Lawrence Summers would like to meet with you, the email said somewhat cryptically. It was from one of my PhD advisors, Lawrence Katz. Katz didn't tell me why Summers was interested in my work, though I later found out Katz had known all along. I sat in the waiting room outside Summers' office. After some delay, the former Treasury Secretary of the United States, former President of Harvard, and winner of some of the biggest awards in economics, summoned me inside. Summers began the meeting by reading my paper on racism's effect on Obama, which his secretary had printed for him. Summers is a speed reader. As he reads, he occasionally sticks his tongue out and to the right, while his eyes rapidly shift left and right and down the page. Summers reading a social science paper reminds me of a great pianist performing a sonata. He is so focused, he seems to lose track of all else. In fewer than 5 minutes, he has completed my 30-page paper. You say that Google searches for nigger suggest racism, Summers says. That seems plausible. They predict where Obama gets less support than Kerry. That is interesting. Can we really think of Obama and Kerry as the same? They were ranked as having similar ideologies by political scientists, I responded. Also, there is no correlation between racism and changes in House voting. The result stays strong even when we add controls for demographics, church attendance, and gun ownership. This is how we economists talk. I had grown animated. Summers paused and stared at me. He briefly turned to the TV in his office, which was tuned to CNBC, then stared at me again, then looked at the TV, then back at me. Okay, I like this paper, Summers says. What else are you working on? The next 60 minutes may have been the most intellectually exhilarating of my life. Summers and I talked about interest rates and inflation, policing and crime, business and charity. There is a reason so many people who meet Summers are enthralled. I've been fortunate to speak with some incredibly smart people in my life. Summers struck me as the smartest. He's obsessed with ideas more than all else, which seems to be what often gets him in trouble. He had to resign his presidency at Harvard after suggesting the possibility that part of the reason for the shortage of women in the sciences might be that men have more variation in their IQs. If he finds an idea interesting, Summers tends to say it, even if it offends some ears. It was now a half hour past the scheduled end time for our meeting. The conversation was intoxicating, but I still had no idea why I was there, nor when I was supposed to leave, nor how I would know when I was supposed to leave. I got the feeling by this point that Summers himself may have forgotten why he had set up this meeting. And then he asked the million-dollar or perhaps billion-dollar question. You think you can predict the stock market with this data? Aha. Here at last was the reason Summers had summoned me to his office. Summers is hardly the first person to ask me this particular question. My father has generally been supportive of my unconventional research interests, but one time he did broach the subject. Racism, child abuse, abortion, he said. Can't you make any money off this expertise of yours? Friends and other family members have raised the subject as well. So have co-workers and strangers on the internet. Everyone seems to want to know whether I can use Google searches or other big data to pick stocks. Now it was the former Treasury Secretary of the United States. This was more serious. So can new big data sources successfully predict which ways stocks are headed? The short answer is no. In the previous chapters, we discussed the four powers of big data. This chapter is all about big data's limitations, both what we cannot do with it, and on occasion, what we ought not do with it. And one place to start is by telling the story of the failed attempt by Summers and myself to beat the markets. In Chapter 3, we noted that new data is most likely to yield big returns when the existing research in a given field is weak. It is an unfortunate truth about the world that you will have a much easier time getting new insights about racism, child abuse, or abortion than you will getting a new profitable insight into how a business is performing. That's because massive resources are already devoted to looking for even the slightest edge in measuring business performance. The competition in finance is fierce. That was already a strike against us. Summers, who is not someone known for effusing about other people's intelligence, was certain the hedge funds were already way ahead of us. I was quite taken during our conversation by how much respect he had for them, and how many of my suggestions he was convinced they'd beaten us to. I proudly shared with him an algorithm I had devised that allowed me to obtain more complete Google Trends data. He said it was clever. When I asked him if Renaissance, a quantitative hedge fund, would have figured out that algorithm, he chuckled and said, "Yeah, of course they would have figured that out." The difficulty of keeping up with the hedge funds wasn't the only fundamental problem that Summers and I ran up against in using new big data sets to beat the markets. The curse of dimensionality. Suppose your strategy for predicting the stock market is to find a lucky coin, but one that will be found through careful testing. Here's your methodology. You label 1,000 coins, 1 to 1,000. Every morning for 2 years, you flip each coin, record whether it came up heads or tails, and then note whether the Standard & Poor's index went up or down that day. You pour through all your data, and voila, you've found something. It turns out that 70.3% of the time coin 391 came up heads, the S&P index rose. The relationship is statistically significant, highly so. You have found your lucky coin. Just flip coin 391 every morning and buy stocks whenever it comes up heads. Your days of Target t-shirts and ramen noodle dinners are over. Coin 391 is your ticket to the good life. Or not. You have become another victim of one of the most diabolical aspects of the curse of dimensionality. It can strike whenever you have lots of variables or dimensions, in this case, 1,000 coins, chasing not that many observations, in this case, 504 trading days over those 2 years. One of those dimensions, coin 391 in this case, is likely to get lucky. Decrease the number of variables, flip only 100 coins, and it will become much less likely that one of them will get lucky. Increase the number of observations, try to predict the behavior of the S&P index for 20 years, and coins will struggle to keep up. The curse of dimensionality is a major issue with big data, since newer data sets frequently give us exponentially more variables than traditional data sources. Every search term, every category of tweet, etc. Many people who claim to predict the market utilizing some big data source have merely been entrapped by the curse. All they've really done is find the equivalent of coin 391. Take, for example, a team of computer scientists from Indiana University and Manchester University who claimed they could predict which way the markets would go based on what people were tweeting. They built an algorithm to code the world's day-to-day moods based on tweets. They used techniques similar to the sentiment analysis discussed in Chapter 3. However, they coded not just one mood, but many moods. Happiness, anger, kindness, and more. They found that a preponderance of tweets suggesting calmness, such as, "I feel calm," predicts that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is likely to rise 6 days later. A hedge fund was founded to exploit their findings. What's the problem here? The fundamental problem is that they tested too many things, and if you test enough things, just by random chance one of them will be statistically significant. They tested many emotions, and they tested each emotion 1 day before, 2 days before, 3 days before, and up to 7 days before the stock market behavior that they were trying to predict. And all these variables were used to try to explain just a few months of Dow Jones ups and downs. Calmness 6 days earlier was not a legitimate predictor of the stock market. Calmness 6 days earlier was the big data equivalent of our hypothetical coin 391. The tweet-based hedge fund was shut down 1 month after starting due to lackluster returns. Hedge funds trying to time the markets with tweets are not the only ones battling the curse of dimensionality. So are the numerous scientists who have tried to find the genetic keys to who we are. Thanks to the Human Genome Project, it is now possible to collect and analyze the complete DNA of people. The potential of this project seemed enormous. Maybe we could find the gene that causes schizophrenia. Maybe we could discover the gene that causes Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS. Maybe we could find the gene that causes, gulp, intelligence. Is there one gene that can add a whole bunch of IQ points? Is there one gene that makes a genius? In 1998, Robert Plowman, a prominent behavioral geneticist, claimed to have found the answer. He received a dataset that included the DNA and IQs of hundreds of students. He compared the DNA of geniuses, those with IQs of 160 or higher, to the DNA of those with average IQs. He found a striking difference in the DNA of these two groups. It was located in one small corner of chromosome 6, an obscure but powerful gene that was used in the metabolism of the brain. One version of this gene, named IGF2R, was twice as common in geniuses. "First gene to be linked with high intelligence is reported found," headlined the New York Times. You may think of the many ethical questions Plomin's finding raised. Should parents be allowed to screen their kids for IGF-2R? Should they be allowed to abort a baby with a low IQ variant? Should we genetically modify people to give them a high IQ? Does IGF-2R correlate with race? Do we want to know the answer to that question? Should research on the genetics of IQ continue? Before bioethicists had to tackle any of these thorny questions, there was a more basic question for geneticists, including Plomin himself. Was the result accurate? Was it really true that IGF-2R could predict IQ? Was it really true that geniuses were twice as likely to carry a certain variant of this gene? Nope. A few years after his original study, Plomin got access to another sample of people that also included their DNA and IQ scores. This time, IGF-2R did not correlate with IQ. Plomin, and this is a sign of a good scientist, retracted his claim. This, in fact, has been a general pattern in the research into genetics and IQ. First, scientists report that they have found a genetic variant that predicts IQ. Then scientists get new data and discover their original assertion was wrong. For example, in a recent paper, a team of scientists led by Christopher Chabris examined 12 prominent claims about genetic variants associated with IQ. They examined data from 10,000 people. They could not reproduce the correlation for any of the 12. What's the issue with all of these claims? The curse of dimensionality. The human genome, scientists now know, differs in millions of ways. There are quite simply too many genes to test. If you test enough tweets to see if they correlate with the stock market, you will find one that correlates just by chance. If you test enough genetic variants to see if they correlate with IQ, you will find one that correlates just by chance. How can you overcome the curse of dimensionality? You have to have some humility about your work and not fall in love with your results. You have to put these results through additional tests. For example, before you bet your life savings on Coin 391, you would want to see how it does over the next couple of years. Social scientists call this an out-of-sample test. And the more variables you try, the more humble you have to be. The more variables you try, the tougher the out-of-sample test has to be. It is also crucial to keep track of every test you attempt. Then you can know exactly how likely it is you are falling victim to the curse and how skeptical you should be of your results. Which brings us back to Larry Summers and me. Here's how we tried to beat the markets. Summers' first idea was to use searches to predict future sales of key products such as iPhones that might shed light on the future performance of the stock of a company such as Apple. There was indeed a correlation between searches for iPhones and iPhone sales. When people are Googling a lot for iPhones, you can bet a lot of phones are being sold. However, this information was already incorporated into the Apple stock price. Clearly, when there were lots of Google searches for iPhones, hedge funds had also figured out that it would be a big seller, regardless of whether they used the search data or some other source. Summers' next idea was to predict future investment in developing countries. If a large number of investors were going to be pouring money into countries such as Brazil or Mexico in the near future, then stocks for companies in these countries would surely rise. Perhaps we could predict a rise in investment with key Google searches, such as invest in Mexico or investment opportunities in Brazil. This proved a dead end. The problem? The searches were too rare. Instead of revealing meaningful patterns, this search data jumped all over the place. We tried searches for individual stocks. Perhaps if people were searching for GOOG, this meant they were about to buy Google. These searches seemed to predict that the stocks would be traded a lot, but they did not predict whether the stocks would rise or fall. One major limitation is that these searches did not tell us whether someone was interested in buying or selling the stock. One day, I excitedly showed Summers a new idea I had. Past searches for buy gold seemed to correlate with future increases in the price of gold. Summers told me I should test it going forward to see if it remained accurate. It stopped working, perhaps because some hedge fund had found the same relationship. In the end, over a few months, we didn't find anything useful in our tests. Undoubtedly, if we had looked for a correlation with market performance in each of the billions of Google search terms, we would have found one that worked, however weakly. but it likely would have just been our own coin 391. The overemphasis on what is measurable. In March 2012, Zoe Chance, a marketing professor at Yale, received a small white pedometer in her office mailbox in downtown New Haven, Connecticut. She aimed to study how this device, which measures the steps you take during the day and gives you points as a result, can inspire you to exercise more. What happened next, as she recounted in a TEDx talk, was a big data nightmare. Chance became so obsessed and addicted to increasing her numbers that she began walking everywhere, from the kitchen to the living room, to the dining room, to the basement, in her office. She walked early in the morning, late at night, at nearly all hours of the day, 20,000 steps in a given 24-hour period. She checked her pedometer hundreds of times per day, and much that remained of her human communication was with other pedometer users online discussing strategies to improve scores. She remembers putting the pedometer on her 3-year-old daughter when her daughter was walking because she was so obsessed with getting the number higher. Chance became so obsessed with maximizing this number that she lost all perspective. She forgot the reason someone would want to get the number higher, exercising, not having her daughter walk a few steps. Nor did she complete any academic research about the pedometer. She finally got rid of the device after falling late one night, exhausted, while trying to get in more steps. Though she is a data-driven researcher by profession, the experience affected her profoundly. "It makes me skeptical of whether having access to additional data is always a good thing," Chance says. This is an extreme story, but it points to a potential problem with people using data to make decisions. Numbers can be seductive. We can grow fixated with them, and in so doing, we can lose sight of more important considerations. Zoe Chance lost sight, more or less, of the rest of her life. Even less obsessive infatuations with numbers can have drawbacks. Consider the 21st century emphasis on testing in American schools and judging teachers based on how their students score. While the desire for more objective measures of what happens in classrooms is legitimate, there are many things that go on there that can't readily be captured in numbers. Moreover, all of that testing pressured many teachers to teach to the tests, and worse. A small number, as was proven in a paper by Brian Jacob and Stephen Levitt, cheated outright in administering those tests. The problem is this. The things we can measure are often not exactly what we care about. We can measure how students do on multiple-choice questions. We can't easily measure critical thinking, curiosity, or personal development. Just trying to increase a single, easy-to-measure number, test scores, or the number of steps taken in a day, doesn't always help achieve what we are really trying to accomplish. In its efforts to improve its site, Facebook runs into this danger as well. The company has tons of data on how people use the site. It's easy to see whether a particular newsfeed story was liked, clicked on, commented on, or shared. But according to Alex Pesakovich, a Facebook data scientist with whom I have written about these matters, not one of these is a perfect proxy for more important questions. What was the experience of using the site like? Did the story connect the user with her friends? Did it inform her about the world? Did it make her laugh? Or consider baseball's data revolution in the 1990s. Many teams began using increasingly intricate statistics rather than relying on old-fashioned human scouts to make decisions. It was easy to measure offense and pitching, but not fielding. So some organizations ended up underestimating the importance of defense. In fact, in his book The Signal and the Noise, Nate Silver estimates that the Oakland A's, a data-driven organization profiled in Moneyball, were giving up 8 to 10 wins per year in the mid-90s because of their lousy defense. The solution is not always more big data. A special sauce is often necessary to help big data work best. The judgment of humans and small surveys, what we might call small data. In an interview with Silver, Billy Bean, the A's then general manager and the main character in Moneyball, said that he actually had begun increasing his scouting budget. To fill in the gaps in its giant data pool, Facebook too has to take an old-fashioned approach, asking people what they think. Every day as they load their newsfeed, hundreds of Facebook users are presented with questions about the stories they see there. Facebook's automatically collected datasets, likes, clicks, comments, are supplemented, in other words, by smaller data. Do you want to see this post in your newsfeed? Why? Yes, even a spectacularly successful big data organization like Facebook sometimes makes use of the source of information much disparaged in this audiobook, a small survey. Indeed, because of this need for small data as a supplement to its mainstay, massive collections of clicks, likes, and posts, Facebook's data teams look different than you might guess. Facebook employs social psychologists, anthropologists, and sociologists precisely to find what the numbers miss. Some educators, too, are becoming more alert to blind spots in big data. There is a growing national effort to supplement mass testing with small data. Student surveys have proliferated, so have parent surveys and teacher observations, where other experienced educators watch a teacher during a lesson. School districts realize they shouldn't be focusing solely on test scores, says Thomas Kane, a professor of education at Harvard. A 3-year study by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation bears out the value in education of both big and small data. The authors analyzed whether test score-based models, student surveys, or teacher observations were best at measuring which teachers most improved student learning. When they put the 3 measures together into a composite score, they got the best results. Each measure adds something of value, the report concluded. In fact, it was just as I was learning that many big data operations use small data to fill in the holes that I showed up in Ocala, Florida to meet Jeff Sader. Remember, he was the Harvard-educated horse guru who used lessons learned from a huge data set to predict the success of American Pharoah. After sharing all the computer files and math with me, Sader admitted that he had another weapon, Patty Murray. Murray, like Sader, has high intelligence and elite credentials, a degree from Bryn Mawr. She also left New York City for rural life. I like horses more than humans, Murray admits. But Murray is a bit more traditional in her approaches to evaluating horses. She, like many horse agents, personally examines horses, seeing how they walk, checking for scars and bruises, and interrogating their owners. Murray then collaborates with Sader as they pick the final horses they want to recommend. Murray sniffs out problems with the horses, problems that Sader's data, despite being the most innovative and important dataset ever collected on horses, still misses. I am predicting a revolution based on the revelations of big data, but this does not mean we can just throw data at any question, and big data does not eliminate the need for all the other ways humans have developed over the millennia to understand the world. They complement each other. 8. Mo data, mo problems? What we shouldn't do. Sometimes the power of big data is so impressive, it's scary. It raises ethical questions. The danger of empowered corporations. Recently, 3 economists, Oded Netzer and Alan Lemaire, both of Columbia, and Michael Herzenstein of the University of Delaware, looked for ways to predict the likelihood of whether a borrower would pay back a loan. The scholars utilized data from Prosper, a peer-to-peer lending site. Potential borrowers write a brief description of why they need a loan and why they are likely to make good on it, and potential lenders decide whether to provide them the money. Overall, about 13% of borrowers defaulted on their loan. It turns out the language that potential borrowers use is a strong predictor of their probability of paying back, and it's an important indicator even if you control for other relevant information lenders were able to obtain about those potential borrowers, including credit ratings and income. Listed below are 10 phrases the researchers found that are commonly used when applying for a loan. 5 of them positively correlate with paying back the loan, 5 of them negatively correlate with paying back the loan. In other words, 5 tend to be used by people you can trust, 5 by people you cannot. See if you can guess which are which. God, promise, debt-free, minimum payment, lower interest rate, will pay, graduate, thank you, after tax, hospital. You might think, or at least hope, that a polite, openly religious person who gives his word would be among the most likely to pay back a loan, but in fact this is not the case. This type of person, the data shows, is less likely than average to make good on their debt. Here are the phrases grouped by the likelihood of paying back. Terms used in loan applications by people most likely to pay back: debt-free, lower interest rate, after-tax, minimum payment, graduate. Terms used in loan applications by people most likely to default: God, promise, will pay, thank you, hospital. Before we discuss the ethical implications of this study, let's think through, with the help of the study's authors, what it reveals about people. What should we make of the words in the different categories? First, let's consider the language that suggests someone is more likely to make their loan payments. Phrases such as lower interest rate or after tax indicate a certain level of financial sophistication on the borrower's part, so it's perhaps not surprising they correlate with someone more likely to pay their loan back. In addition, if he or she talks about positive achievements such as being a college graduate and being debt-free, he or she is also likely to pay their loans. Now let's consider language that suggests someone is unlikely to pay their loans. Generally, if someone tells you he will pay you back, he will not pay you back. The more assertive the promise, the more likely he will break it. If someone writes, "I promise I will pay back, so help me God," he is among the least likely to pay you back. Appealing to your mercy, explaining that he needs the money because he has a relative in the hospital, also means he is unlikely to pay you back. In fact, mentioning any family member, a husband, wife, son, daughter, mother, or father, is a sign someone will not be paying back. Another word that indicates default is explain, meaning if people are trying to explain why they are going to be able to pay back a loan, they likely won't. The authors did not have a theory for why thanking people is evidence of likely default. In sum, according to these researchers, giving a detailed plan of how he can make his payments and mentioning commitments he has kept in the past are evidence someone will pay back a loan. Making promises and appealing to your mercy is a clear sign someone will go into default. Regardless of the reasons, or what it tells us about human nature, that making promises is a sure sign someone will, in actuality, not do something, the scholars found the test was an extremely valuable piece of information in predicting default. Someone who mentions God was 2.2 times more likely to default. This was among the single highest indicators that someone would not pay back. But the authors also believe their study raises ethical questions. While this was just an academic study, some companies do report that they utilize online data in approving loans. Is this acceptable? Do we want to live in a world in which companies use the words we write to predict whether we will pay back a loan? It is at a minimum creepy and quite possibly scary. A consumer looking for a loan in the near future might have to worry about not merely her financial history, but also her online activity. And she may be judged on factors that seem absurd, whether she uses the phrase "thank you" or invokes God, for example. Further, what about a woman who legitimately needs to help her sister in a hospital and will most certainly pay back her loan afterward? It seems awful to punish her because on average people claiming to need help for medical bills have often been proven to be lying. A world functioning this way starts to look awfully dystopian. This is the ethical question. Do corporations have the right to judge our fitness for their services based on abstract but statistically predictive criteria not directly related to those services? Leaving behind the world of finance, let's look at the larger implications on, for example, hiring practices. Employers are increasingly scouring social media when considering job candidates. That may not raise ethical questions if they're looking for evidence of bad-mouthing previous employers or revealing previous employers' secrets. There may even be some justification for refusing to hire someone whose Facebook or Instagram posts suggest excessive alcohol use. But what if they find a seemingly harmless indicator that correlates with something they care about? Researchers at Cambridge University and Microsoft gave 58,000 U.S. Facebook users a variety of tests about their personality and intelligence. They found that